Okay, so
just a reminder that we do have exam two sort of starting to get on the horizon at the April 11th. So factor that into your thinking about where your time is going to go in a week.
Will you do this on one of the 4 days?
You have one more on 4 days stuff. Well, you got to have problems out of Gene Kohler, because Gene Kohler didn't do those.
So. Oh, this is okay.
But she, you know, we did one, yeah, there was one homework problem and one workshop problem that was okay. Yeah. So.
That's
very
dangerous.
Oh, yeah. 4A is definitely fair game for exam two. The part of what I need to do sometime this week is actually think carefully about what is fair game and make sure that you're on, that I give you such a list. Yeah. No. My intent is to have this test cover the material from the end of the exam one material to now. Now, that's always a little messy in physics because things tend to build, so it's a little bit hard to do anything in that period without also sort of taking advantage of wave craft that we did earlier, right? So in a sense, but no, I'll be focusing on the stuff in that time. And it will assume some knowledge of the things that you had to feed into it, for sure, but I won't be deliberately picking out anything during that period, during the earlier period of the test you want. The final will be cumulative, though. The tests are for the individual parts. And I will, this is going to be a pain, I forgot to bring my cord, sorry. I will try to send you a list of specific topics and lecture and reading and stuff that this covers. One thing that I did change is that the room is not going to be in Bassano 106, but it will be in Dewey 1101, because 106 was too small. I haven't actually walked over to see 1101, so I hope it's actually bigger than 106, which was the intent. That's what I requested. So hopefully we won't be as tight. And I think for the final, they also assigned us into a smallish room, and I asked for much. I think we got, I have to verify, maybe lower strong or something like this. Because bounce around with beads in there. I'll let you know. I could be, other things might be really confused in my mind about that. Anyway, so I will be in Dewey 1101. The other thing that is, I have to go to Japan and work on my research starting tomorrow for a week. And so that means we'll have no lectures here next week, but I will post lectures, hopefully Monday's lecture before Monday, your time, and hopefully Wednesday's lecture before Wednesday. And so I expect you to go through them, and if you have questions, go ahead and email, and then we'll have things as normal the following week. Okay, and then, so this is my Japanese apology. It's actually really great if you go driving around Japan every time there's a construction zone, there'll be signs for the gravely sorry for the inconvenience that they give you. It sort of makes you feel good in a way, the U.S., you know, construction zone, don't smash our workers or face a $3 billion fine, signs don't quite do. So... all right. So last time we were continuing with the whole study of life, and one of the things that we did was we looked at diffraction. Single slip diffraction. And this time I managed to get the single slip demo. So now what we have is a single slip, and as you can see, we have this intense max, this intense light right in the center, the central maximum, and then you have the pattern for the fraction where you have that central maximum and then you have the less intense pieces falling off to each side. And now what I want to do is I want to actually adjust this. So I'm going to try to screw it in a little bit. Every time I touch it. Okay. And now what I'm doing is I'm adjusting the slit width. And apparently, I'm making it wider. And as I do, you'll note that that intensity maximum in the center gets narrower and brighter. And you bring in sort of the whole pattern collapses a little bit. Okay? And now I'm going to try to go the other way and see if I can narrow it down. For example, now I've narrowed it down, so the diffraction is a bigger effect. So the slit width is on the order of the wavelength of the light. As you begin to, and when you get that effect, you'll start to now, the diffraction itself will become a much bigger effect. And you'll begin to see that central maximum spread out. Okay? And that's diffraction. Another thing that you've probably seen problems on. We've looked at thin film interference a bit. And there's one sort of famous example of interference where you put a piece of glass that has this shape sitting on a piece of glass like this, and you send the light in from this direction and you look at what happens. And we basically have a setup to do that. And what would you expect to see with something like this if these are round lenses, round pieces of glass? Let's assume it's a single frequency of glass. What he said, rainbow. Yeah, you will see something in the rainbow. A fringe pattern. Okay, what do you think you would see? Okay. You'll see concentric circles, right? Because the light comes in, and basically you can think of the light being reflected from this surface and this surface as the piece that's giving you the interference. And so the phase, you have a 180-degree phase difference right at that point. So I would expect to see a dark spot right at the center. And then as you work your way out, you have the 180-degree phase difference between those two with the additional path length. And so as you go out and you get an additional 2D, when this distance traversing down and then back up is equal to 2D, you'll have yet another dark fringe. So we have a setup so that we hopefully can see that up here. And just like I told you, you have that beautiful dark spot right in the center. You see that? Beautiful dark spot? All right. Well, that just goes to show that unless I rip this apart, I probably can't tell you why it is exactly like it is. But you do have nice interference fringes, of course, so whatever. Okay. Our friend James Clerk Maxwell tells us light is a wave. You know, I know it has to be one of the top two buttons here, which means my odds of getting the right one is 50%. And I swear to God, I get it 80% wrong. Okay, so now you tell me, because I want to know if you're true believers, right? Why should you believe life is way? Say what? Our clear evidence of superposition. So you've got interference, you've got diffraction, you've got refraction, which is a different effect, but still. You've got behaving the same way as sound, so you do get those kinds of diffractive and refractive effects. Maxwell's equations work. They work really well, right? And they clearly tell you mathematically that the electromagnetic fields satisfy wave equations. Now, they're a little bit weird for waves. Every other wave we know is a mechanical wave, where you've got something you can look at that's physically moving and physically connected with other things, okay? These are weird because you don't really have an electric field that is connected to the electric field beside it in a sense. It has this indirect connection, which is through its coupling to the magnetic field and induction. So it's a very bizarre and beautiful sort of phenomenon. And that allows it to move through a vacuum in space, which no other wave we know can. With the exception of, I guess, gravity waves eventually. We hope we discover something. But so we have lots of reasons to believe light is a wave, and it's not even close. It's a very well established fact. And I want you to think for a moment about what life would have been like if you were a physics geek in the late 1890s. Newton solved basically everything. Gravity, you can understand the planetary motion, you can do mechanics stuff, you can tell the artillery guys how to hit what they want to hit. You can describe the motion of bodies very well. And then what he didn't get, Maxwell got. All the electromagnetic phenomena is now synthesized. The phenomenon of light, which is very well studied in the lab with optical devices, they're real good at this stuff. Okay? So, there's not a lot left. Physicists were actually discouraged from going into physics because they really know it all. Seriously. So there wasn't a whole lot left to worry about. There were a few things that weren't yet cleanly understood within the framework. And you know, the attitude is that's fine. You know, one of the youngsters will get smart and figure it out at some point, or somebody will work it out. So there are lots of little things. And so one of the things that was a puzzle at the time was how light really interacted with matter. And if you really want to know how light interacts with matter, one of the things you'd like to do is to divorce what you observe from the spectrum of the light itself that's incident on it. Because if I want to understand matter and how it interacts with light, I mean, I guess part of that is to understand reflection. But really what I'd like to do is to look at the light that is in thermal equilibrium with the matter itself, and not corrupt it with incident light where I'm vulnerable to the spectrum. And you've already seen, and you can tell, you can take something that's completely different under this lighting than it does outside. And you know, you can see it very dramatically if you look at different settings on a digital camera, sometimes with the same picture, with sort of assuming different spectra of light. So a way to manufacture a situation where you can study sort of how light interacts with the matter itself, and you're not so much prone to have to worry about the incident light spectrum, would be to basically create a cavity, okay, some sort of cavity, and you put a small hole in the cavity. There's a big hole, but imagine a very small hole in that cavity. Now, if I have sort of a hole surrounded by material, there is light that gets inside, but it's very little, and it's coming at some weird angle. Okay, so that light that comes inside here from out here will bounce around inside that cavity and basically become thermalized with whatever the cavity is. So why do I say thermalized? Well, I mean, it may seem a little bit odd because we think of things like incandescent light and gases that are heated up as things that emit light and glow. But in fact, everything glows. Everything emits thermal radiation. And it's really just a question of what is the frequency range over which they do it. So you can study that by taking this object and through the pinhole literally look and see what light actually comes out of the pinhole. So the way to imagine is light that is incident through the hole inside this cavity is sort of lost in here. But if I heat the cavity up, you can imagine, if I heat the thing up till it's glowing really hot inside, what are you going to see? You're going to see bright light coming straight out of that hole. So light, which is divorced from incident spectrum, which is a product of the thermal emission of the material in this way, is what we call black body radiation. Okay? And it happens to have a very characteristic spectrum, which even in the late 1800s, was very well studied. And what you see when you look at it is that the distribution in terms of wavelength looks something like this. There's a characteristic peak, and it drops off as you go up in wavelength and down in wavelength. And as you heat the material up, the temperature, what you find is that the shape, first of all, you're adding a lot of energy, so the light becomes more intense. So you get, if you integrate under this peak and look at how much spectral energy you have, you'll have more and more as you make it hotter. But the other thing you'll notice, the peak of the distribution moves over, so the light gets distributed both because you're adding in more energy, but also because this peak is shifting as you heat it up. So these curves represent different temperatures for this object. So this one is at 2,000 degrees Kelvin. This one's at 3,300 degrees Kelvin. And one thing you'll notice is that the relative amount of the light that's emitted as a function of wavelength shifts over to shorter wavelength, which is higher frequency. Okay? If we superimpose the visible spectrum on this, so that's sort of in this region, you can see that as you heat this thing up, you begin to move light in from the far red into where you have substantial contributions from the green and the blue. So this is not news to you, right? You all mess around with pokers in the fireplace or campfire stuff. And when you get something really good and hot, it goes from sort of deep red, it starts getting less deep red, so a bright red, and then it will sort of go more white and blue, even blue hot. So blue hot is hotter than white hot, which is hotter than red hot, which is, and so you've all seen, if you have a standard heating element on a stove, it glows a nice bright red, and you turn it off and you watch it, it sort of goes into a much deeper red, and then you lose sight. It doesn't mean it's no longer hot. It is very much glowing, but it's now glowing in infrared, mostly. In fact, all of these curves are beautiful, so they're all hot. Yeah?
What is the unit of why it's
hot? This says relative spectral radiant flux. So that basically is intensity per meter squared, but it's relative for these different curves. So it's just they're all normalized to something. I don't know what. I didn't want to drag you through that. So
is there so this is a question how do you know, but are there materials we can get people to really work?
All materials have to glow at very low temperature. It's just a question of what the frequency is in which they glow. So the cosmic microwave background, for example, is equivalent to a thermal body at 4.3 degrees Kelvin, and it glows in the microwaves. That's where the peak is.
So even like the web right here glows?
Yeah. Yeah. Huh? Oh, man.
It's such a power.
Yeah, I probably can. I'm sorry?
I thought you would try to get it work again.
I did. It's working for me. Well, that's a weird one. I see it, so I don't know why that disappeared. So I'll try turning on the auxiliary projector and see if that works. Some sort of... When I guess that thought this went off somehow and it broke the connection. Yes, it's glowing, in fact. Okay. Well, I'll lecture to myself here. Are we appearing somewhere? Okay. All right. I think I'm going to try to mostly stand here so I can keep irritating this thing. All right. So you'll notice that as we get hotter, we go to lower frequency with the peak. And in fact, that's quantitatively understood. There's a law that we can use called Wien's law from Guy Wilhelm Wien, who did analyze this in a thermodynamic sort of way. And he looked at measurements and he found that you can actually measure the peak of this spectrum as a function of temperature, and that's equal to some constant. So this is pretty well understood. So you might imagine, look, we know matter is sort of made up of charged particles. We totally understand charged particles. We totally understand light. So now what I'd like to do is to derive about the simplest thing you can imagine to derive that has to do with matter and light, which would be the spectrum of the glowing light from an object, or the blackbody spectrum. And so people tried to do that. And Dean had some luck, and I'm not actually sure exactly what he did, but he came close. The red line would be the actual experimental data at some particular at 7,000 degrees, and we'll get to Mr. Planck in a minute. But the standard classical analysis treats the light in the object as being made up of standing waves of a continuum of frequencies. And each mode of the standing wave then thermodynamically actually shares in the energy by taking some measure of kT. So if you look at the distribution of kinetic energies, for example, of atoms in a gas at a certain temperature, what you find is that each degree of freedom in the gas, that is each way in which it can vibrate, takes one-half kT in energy, where K is something called Boltzmann's constant. And I don't know that you guys have done this, right? Having in chemistry, you do it, yeah. So this is one of the places where we probably skimped on your stuff, but that would be thermodynamics. And when you assume that the energy stored in the gas depends on each of these degrees of freedom, you actually get the energy right. So if I have a diatomic molecule, which also has a degree of freedom of rotation, it actually holds more energy. And so instead of 3 halves total KT in there, you have 5 halves KT. So this is pretty well understood. And so people applied the same sort of thinking to this. And what you find is that as you go to high frequency, low frequency, as you go to high frequency, the wavelength becomes shorter and shorter. So you really get a continuum of these standing waves. And what will happen is that as you go to shorter wavelengths or higher frequency, you get a divergence in how much energy that you can have in there. So the intensity basically diverges. And you end up with what's known as the ultraviolet catastrophe. And so this is what classical physics really tells you is going to happen. This thing just diverges as you go up the high frequencies. And that is not what is seen in the laboratory. And this is a problem because this is based on stuff people really didn't understand. So this was a mystery at the time. And then along came a guy in 1900 named Max Planck. He was German and he won the Nobel Prize for this work in 1918. But he made what I call the black body radiation hypothesis in 1900. And he came up with a pretty strange idea. And what he had to do was to set out and try to figure a way to limit the degrees of freedom that you would have in the modes and how much energy and the number of modes that would have energy in them as you go to shorter wavelengths. And that's sort of what he needed to do. And what he found was that if he made this completely wacky assumption that the energy at a given frequency could only come in packets, which were quantized. You could have none, you could have H nu, you could have 2H nu, 3H nu. Then he discretized and limited the number of degrees of freedom. And then when he works this out, which I decided not to derive for you guys, you can be thankful, okay? Or if you want, I will apologize greatly for not deriving it for you. If you're interested, I can point you to places where you can get it. But he made this assumption, okay? And then from that, using statistical mechanics techniques, he derived an expression for the intensity of the light as a function of wavelength and temperature, and he got this expression. Now, this quantity H was an unknown constant. Okay, he didn't know what this thing was. He just made it up. He just said, I have packets of energy that depend on the frequency linearly, because that's about the simplest dependence you can have. He wants it to depend on the frequency because of the problem he's setting out to solve. Right? He wants to limit it on both ends and intensity. So when he makes this assumption, and he derives, you know, once you have that assumption, the rest just falls out pretty straightforward from classical thermodynamics, statistical mechanics. Except he has this unknown constant. And then he basically can take this formula, and it turns out to have the shape that you see in the data, but he has to determine the constant. So he then determines a constant where it fits the data, which is this, he's determined this number, which we now call Planck's constant. And what he found was that he could then describe the black body radiation curve as well as it could be measured. Okay, exactly. He was dead on. So then we have sort of a funny situation. Because he was so close, his curve was clearly the right curve. So we even have the formula. The problem is he made a completely salacious and wacky assumption to derive. So people said, okay, point's right. But now we have to figure out how to get that formula from something that makes sense. So that was basically the attitude at the time. It wasn't well received. It was a pretty wacky, and I hope you can appreciate how completely out of left field that idea is. Because he's saying that light has particulate characteristics. If it comes in little quantum of energy, waves clearly have continuous energy. Right? So just for completeness here, I should put up a couple of these constants. So H we now call Planck's constant. I don't actually know what he called it. I somehow doubt he called it Planck's constant, but maybe, I don't know. K is Boltzmann's constant. And that's one that you see all the time in statistical mechanics and thermodynamics. So that one's classically well understood and evaluated from other things. Yeah. And Planck's constant, which of course I'm sure he didn't evaluate the three spaces, but so he comes up with this crazy idea, and then everybody sort of shrugs and say, okay, that seems to work, but it's clearly there's a problem. Okay? So that was step one. Then came, only a few years later, well, what had already been seen for a while. So the black body radiation mystery had been known for some time, and it was a puzzle. Then Planck came along in 1900. We now have the right formula, but we don't really understand why we have it, because his assumption's crazy. There was another thing that wasn't completely understood, which was called the photoelectric effect. And the photoelectric effect is really pretty simple. It is, if you shine light onto a metal surface, especially heavy metal surfaces and stuff, you can get electrons ejected from the metal. So photoelectric effect, right? And this was actually a fairly well measured thing. And the way that you measure it would be to to have a heavy metal of some sort, and you shine light on this, and you put a potential difference across this surface. So you make a circuit that looks something like this. And then what will happen is as you kick electrons out, if you have no potential difference, they'll come over here and you can measure that you get a current, which is how you measure for the intensity and the frequency of the light. You measure what the current is in your circuit by putting a sensitive ammeter in here. And then you put a reverse potential on this thing by basically making this side a little bit negative and that positive. And now what happens is for a given frequency and intensity of light, you get electrons kicked off of here, and they'll have a certain kinetic energy. And if they have enough energy to get across this gap, then you'll get a current. So you can tune the potential here to where you just stop the current. And when you do that, you get a measure of what the maximum energy of the electrons are that are coming off of that metal. Okay? So then what you plot would be for, you could plot, for example, the intensity of the current or the degree of the current as a function of the frequency of the light or the intensity of the light or things like that. Okay? So then the question is, what would you expect to see classically? Light's a wave. You have electrons in the metal, whatever that stuff is, right? Eventually the electrons get enough energy to jump out of the metal. What would you expect to see classically? Well, if you have a wave, so the light is a wave. Assume light's a wave, what do you see? Because we all know light's a wave.
It should be.
Planck was crazier than shit. Well, we see the electrons, so we know the energy is being absorbed somehow.
Yeah, so it would be a constant function.
Well, okay, but we know the energy in light does depend on frequency. Or the intensity, right? So
or the higher frequency.
So let's see. If you have light that has little energy, then classically the electrons will sit there and absorb the energy until they have enough energy that they can basically break through. So one of the things you expect to see classically in this is that no matter what the frequency is, you would expect to see some electrons. Okay? And if you raise the intensity of the light, you expect them to absorb that energy faster, so you sort of expect to see a higher current. So that's in part classical expectation. So what you actually see is the current as a function of the frequency. Doesn't matter the material, you'll have no current, no current, no current, and then all of a sudden you'll have a linear increase like that. And this would be the intensity of the, this would be the current, sorry. And I'm going to write current here because I don't want you to think of that as the intensity of the light, necessarily. So what we're doing with this curve is we're varying the frequency. And down here, I'm sorry, I made a mistake there. This is the kinetic energy of the electron. So as you vary the frequency of the light, it does not matter how intense that light is. You get nothing, 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 and then all of a sudden you begin to get some, and then what you see is that the kinetic energy of the electron that's coming off the metal increases linearly with the frequency. Yes?
This is what actually happens in real time.
Right, this is what's actually happening. And so, the statement is it's in egregious disagreement with what you would expect from classical wave physics.
draw what you would expect.
Draw what you would expect graphically.
What would that graph look like?
Yeah. Oh, as a function of frequency, you would have basically, I think you would have something all the way. Every frequency would give you something, right? It's just that lower frequencies you might not. They might come off with as much energy, but you would have something, and it would be intensity dependent. That would be actually a very important fact here. You would have an intensity dependence there that you don't see in classical, and you don't see in the light. It doesn't matter how bright the light is here. It doesn't do anything.
So it doesn't matter
what
surface
is? I mean, what's typically, these are usually heavy metal surfaces. I mean...
So what's the frequency of the surface?
Okay, so let's talk about what's happening, but let me tell you the story of who did it first. Say no light intensity dependence. I mean, if you have no light, of course you're going to see nothing, but that's okay. So along comes Einstein, and in 1905 he came up with this idea, and what he said was, this picture is consistent if you assume that the kinetic energy of the electron is equal to the energy of the light minus what's usually called W. He called it the work function. And you can really think of this as the binding energy of the electron in the metal. But what he said that was really very new and was revolutionary was, he said, if we assume that the light of a given frequency comes in a bundle, which is quantized, then what happens is, when this energy is less than the work function, the light can interact with that electron all day long, but it doesn't have enough energy to kick the electron out of the metal. The moment that you get to where H nu is above the work function, the electrons begin to be emitted. And as you increase the frequency, you get a linear dependence on the kinetic energy. The kinetic energy will be linearly growing because the difference between these is growing linearly with frequency. If you now take this picture and you fit data, you get this stupid constant. This is a totally independent thing from blackbody, right? You get the same constant. I mean, overnight, you have light that's quantized. I sort of think of the situation, and it's, in some ways it's a horrible analogy, but I remember on the day of 9/11, I got a call from my wife, and I'm talking on the phone, and she says, some plane hit the World Trade Center. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, in 1929, B-29 hit the Denver State Building. So these things happen, and everybody will be okay. And she says, no, I think it was a big plane, because she'd seen a picture of the news. And I was like, really? how could they do that? You know, and so it was all about how did the accident happen, and while I was on the phone with her, the second night of it. And then it was this instantaneous phase change in our thinking, right? It goes from how can the controllers screw up so badly or that they have engine trouble to immediately understanding because they're terrorists at that. I mean, there's no question. So, not to bring up bad memories, this of course is a much happier thing, but prior to this, the thinking was plants got it, but it's accidental, right? Because life's away, and we all pass away. And now we've got from two completely different and well-established experimental things, very clean explanations that precisely fit the data, and they tell you both that light, they both tell you that light comes in little quanta, and not only that, they give you the same constant that describes the quanta. So people don't really think of Einstein so much for this, but this is what launched quantum mechanics. And it was just one of the things he did that year. It's past the new year to beat all years for any human. So in 1905, he published four papers in the best physics journal of the day, the Analytical Physics, a German publication. We just described this one, which one can really, and I think it's very true, argue it completely launched on that. It basically was the paper that took light from a wave and made people realize it was also a particle. And then we had to deal with that, whatever that means. The Brownian motion. Do you know what Brownian motion is? You ever heard of this? If you take a little drop of oil and you look with a microscope at pollen particles in the oil, they'll sort of do this random walk, which is known as the Brownian motion. And people haven't really understood. Again, they tried to study it. And never, you know, you can quantify, for example, how far this thing moves in a given amount of time by some sort of random walk analysis. And to do that, you have to understand the thermodynamics of what's going on in the thing. And people haven't really understood it, okay? And in this day, it was still not really clear that atoms were for real. That was still an arguable point. The atomic idea had had some success in chemistry because they figured out how to do things in proportions. They've done what the chemists call stoichiometry with their reactions and everything, and they've begun to have some real success with this idea, but it was very much a point of contention. In this paper, Einstein analyzed Brownian motion in terms of the statistical mechanics of thermodynamics of this piece of pollen getting knocked around by the random motion of the atom. So it was the first direct experimental handle that really said very clearly that matter is a pollen. And the biggest proponent for the continuous nature of matter, the non-atomic side, said that at some point, this was the paper that convinced him early on. So this was a really important paper. It, in a sense, really established atoms and molecules. Oh, and then, by the way, that same year, he happened to revolutionize our entire view of space and time, which you've now seen, and, oh, matter and energy, and launched the nuclear age. All in 1 year. That's just amazing. So, I think a lot of the great advances are in humanity. In human history, it's really driven by some very particular, just amazing individuals. And you know, Newton was clearly one. Einstein was clearly one. And it's just, it's neat. But what a year. Okay. So, the idea here is that at lower frequencies, you don't have the energy to knock the electron off. As you reach an energy where you begin to get current here, you literally now are measuring effectively that binding energy, which is called the work function in photoelectric problems. Okay? And now, the higher the frequency, the more this kinetic energy is, and the more intense the light, actually, the higher the current will be. But the kinetic energy of the electrons, right? You measure current, but it's the threshold of the current that actually tells you the kinetic energy of the electron. So, the photoelectric effect idea, which basically was inspired by Planck, but amazingly worked, and with the same constant, is the thing that explains this. Okay? All right. So another piece to this puzzle came later in 1923 from a guy named Arthur Compton at Washington University. And he described what we now call Compton scattering. He didn't call it. Here's the front page of his paper. Quantum theory of the scattering of X-rays by white elements. And again, this is something that people can do easily in the lab. You take a thin foil, you take X-rays, you put detectors over here, and you study how the frequency and the angle of the scattered X-rays look, how they look. So this is the actual physical process you're trying to study. You have an incident photon that hits incident light, okay, that hits an electron, a free electron, and the light gets scattered, and the electron gets scattered, and you look at the frequency of this light as a function of its wavelength and its angle. And what Compton did, he was doing experiments, but what he did is he derived this formula, and we're going to look at it right now. When he derived this formula, which fit the data perfectly, he had to assume that this light was a photon, that it came with this energy. And they didn't call them photons, by the way. Photons invented by a guy named Gilbert around this time. But up until then, the word hadn't been invented. So what I wanted to do is to just spend a moment and look at this phenomenon of Compton scattering. So let's assume we have light that's incident, and I don't think we really need to make an assumption about what it is at this point, we do that later. But we have an electron that's free, and the final state is this light has scattered somehow, and we want to look at its frequency, and that will depend on these angles, okay, which are all quite measurable. So I want to look at this by just assuming relativity and momentum conservation. So if we look at momentum conservation in the transverse direction, the light is coming straight in, so in the transverse direction the momentum is zero. So in this case, we would match the transverse momentum of this photon to the transverse momentum of the electron. So I'm going to take this PE times the sine of this angle, and that's going to be equal to the momentum of the gamma times the sine of theta. And I'm going to rewrite the momentum of the gamma in terms of E over C, which you can get out of relativity, where we assume the mass is zero, and so momentum will be equal to E over C. So I'm going to pop that in here. So that relates the two angles. Then if we look at momentum conservation in the longitudinal direction, the photon now is coming in with a non-zero longitudinal momentum, and we set that equal to the outgoing longitudinal momentum, which would be the momentum of the gamma times the cosine of its angle, plus the momentum of the electron times the cosine of that angle. we rewrite the gamma as E gamma over C. In this case, I'm saying E gamma is the energy of the incoming electron, and E gamma prime would be the energy of the outgoing photon. I'm sorry. E gamma is the incoming photon, and gamma prime is the outgoing photon. And I'll just say the electron is at rest initially. Its outgoing momentum and energy would be given by the prime. So this is the longitudinal momentum of the outgoing photon, longitudinal momentum of the outgoing electron. And I'm going to take this cosine phi, and I'm going to rewrite it in terms of sine phi by using 1 is equal to cosine squared plus sine squared. So I take the cosine, and I rewrite it in terms of 1 minus sine squared to the 1 half. And then I substitute in for the sine from what we had using the other piece. All right, so I simply take this sine square, and I substituted in what we have here, there. So then I basically regroup terms, multiply by C square, and you end up with this. I'm not going to go through it all that fast. You can look through it in the notes. So we get a relationship. We basically get an equation here for this PE. And then the last thing we can do is we can take conservation of energy. So we have the incoming energy of the photon. We have the energy of the electron, which is its rest mass. So this is the initial state. Outgoing, we have a photon energy, so the E gamma prime. And then the energy of the electron, which basically has its rest mass piece and its momentum kinetic energy piece all thrown together. So I now will take this expression for the PE prime C, which is this mass, and you can plug it in right here. So things start to get a little bit ugly. And I'm going to skip algebraic steps. You can convince yourselves of these things if you want, but there's nothing really but algebra in here. So you can now solve for, once you've plugged that in to here, you can solve for this E gamma prime, which is in the end what we want. We want to get the energy of the photon from the energy of the light going out relative to the energy of the incoming light and how it depends on the angle. And so then it just becomes a bit of algebra. And if you assume at this point, if you assume that the energy of the light that you see is the energy of a photon, okay, where this is Planck's constant, and remember this C over lambda, that's nu, so this is H nu, all right? If you assume it's particular, which we sort of did from the get-go, and you plug in this relationship, then out of that stuff will pop this equation, which is what Compton did off. And then he looks, and it fits the data, again, very well, and again, with the same constant H. So these are the three things that generally are thought of as having established very clearly that light has particular characteristics. So what I showed here are sort of pictures of the data where that if you look at the light coming off at 0 degrees, all you're really seeing is light that's not scattered. As you begin to go off the different angles, you will see some light that's actually scattered off a bound electron, so the photon doesn't lose energy. And then when it's scattered off free electrons, that's really what he's describing here. You'll actually see that the wavelength shifts. So depending on what angle you look at here, you'll see a different wavelength. So the light is scattered off. So what do you think about this? Thank you. How weird is it?
Beautiful.
to entertain myself in high school algebra, learning how to do calligraphy, keep from falling asleep. So, light is vague. Light is a particle. Does that bother you? So what do you think about that? I hope it bothers you. Bothers me, although I don't know. Maybe we shouldn't be bothered. Why are you bothered?
You should be bothered because it's supposed to be confusing. I don't know.
Now, why is it bothering? Right? We have a very particular mental model for particle names, and we've developed a very particular mental model of wave-like things. And in our minds, these are really two disjoint phenomena, right? And in our practical sense in everyday life, it serves us very, very well. But who's to say nature isn't smarter than us? Somehow, right? It's one of these weird things, right? I believe that human intuition is really important in terms of helping focus us into finding usually good paths in creating scientific hypotheses and models. There are lots of instances where human intuition has served us very well. Maxwell's an example of that. I mean, those equations are beautiful, and they're right, insofar as one is ever right in science. But there are also instances where I think we run up against limitations of the human imagination, because in part, we've evolved not needing this, and we've seen it in relativity, right? Einstein's concept of space and time is about as bizarre a thing to a human being as you can possibly imagine. But now we experimentally go and we find that it's true. And in fact, it was driven by experimental stuff, right? I mean, Einstein, in part, was really driven by inconsistency in electromagnetism. But one can also argue in retrospect, although I think it's unclear exactly when this occurred, Einstein, Michelson and Morley had established the speed of light is the same in all reference frames, which is pretty strange. That's pretty weird. And yet, the power of science is that we have to work to overcome it. And now we're running up against this again. I think that I personally have never known anyone who was really happy with this when they first thought it. But it's sort of like relativity. After a while, we begin to get used to it. And it's only really then when we stop and think about how weird it is that we realize just how weird it kind of is. So for whatever reason, we're stuck with the fact that light certainly has wave-like characteristics. It certainly has particle-like characteristics. And which model you use really depends on what question you're trying to answer, typically. And you sort of have to shrug about the fact that nature somehow can do both of these things at the same time. So it's sort of, I believe it's a limitation in our ability to really imagine things at some level. But we're stuck. So, you know, you have wave ripples or whatever you want to call it. Okay?
Could it be particles moving in a wave?
I think the picture that's actually works better is to think of a wave pulse. You can imagine having that. But now I have to stop and think. And certainly you can use sort of wave pulses to do lots of interesting things. And we're going to do that because we'll do a lot more of that. So that is a way to try to get at this. Okay, so light is truly amazing and weird. But if you thought that was weird, get a load of this guy's name.
Louis Victor Pierre Raymond Seven Duc de Brouwer. The Seth, yes. Seth.
Duc de Brouwer. He lived from 1892 to 1987. He was in World War I.
In 19, he was a historian, actually, so be nice to your humanities friends. In 1924, he did a PhD thesis.
And in his PhD thesis, he hypothesized something truly bizarre. And it appears that he was right, and he won the Nobel Prize for it. So that doesn't happen too often. But what he hypothesized is the following. So it was really as simple as, look, if light, which we know to be a wave, can be a particle, maybe particles also get confused and think they're sometimes waves. Okay? And so then he hypothesized something which we call, he says that matter can have wave characteristics. Where they're characterized by a wavelength which depends on the momentum of the particle. Now that may seem completely crazy. So let's see. We know about relativity, so if we have E is equal to the square root of P squared C squared plus M squared C to the fourth, and we're going to set this equal to zero for a photon. So what this tells us, we've already seen it, is that E is equal to PC. Okay? And then, from black body and photoelectric, from the black body and photoelectric effects, we know that E is equal to H nu, and we know that V is equal to lambda nu. So that means that E is equal to HC over lambda. Which tells us that H over lambda is equal to E over C. And E here is equal to PC. That tells us that lambda is equal to H over P. So how would you like to get a Nobel Prize for that? I haven't read his thesis. It probably has a little bit more into it than that. But that was basically that kind of thing. So if you thought light was weird, people are playing with particles all the time, and what you mean it has a wavelength. Right? So if this is true, then I should have a wavelength. You should have a wavelength. Dogs should have wavelengths. Cars should have wavelengths. Baseball should have a wavelength. Right? Certain pitchers, depending on how fast they throw, there will be more diffraction in their throws. Right? That's what they're really hard to hit, because you've really got to focus on that simple maximum you want to make it. But think about it. So,
we don't see this, okay? And I'll come back and do an example. But in fact,
the reason we don't see it, so we'll do a couple of examples and see what the circumstances need to be for you to see the wave-like characteristics of matter. But it turns out the thing you have to do is if you calculate, you saw that the wavelength depends on the momentum of the matter. So it turns out you can calculate, given the momentum of an electron, for example, what its wavelength should be. And then, of course, remember, you will only see diffraction when you have a slit width which is on the order of that wavelength. And it turns out, when you calculate these things for a sort of an electron beam that you can do, you can arrange a situation where the wavelength of the electron is on the order of the spacing between atoms in a crystalline lattice or metal. And in fact, these guys, Clinton Davison and Lester Germer, and this guy independently, George Paget Thompson, observed diffraction of electrons. So this is a very similar pattern to what we just saw with the watch glass, Newton's rings. But this is literally an interference pattern where this is pictured is not formed by light, but formed by the beam of electrons. So it's indisputable evidence that the electrons diffract, that is, they have wave-like characteristics. Yes.
When you were deriving the derivation, the wavelength of matter, you made the assumption that the mass is zero.
Yeah.
About matter, clearly the mass is zero.
Right.
So this seems to suggest that the wavelength of a photon is a zero.
Yeah. No. Oh, okay. Fair enough. So what he was arguing. Yeah. So what I really pulled out here was this relationship for a photon. So the real jump is then you say, if you're thinking of mass, of light as a particle, then why don't we assume mass as a particle, and then ask, does it have the same relationship?
So just kind of checking if that's true.
The sense I have, and I didn't study this period in history in great detail, but the sense I have, it is one part, there's a bit of that. Okay. Intuitive,
maybe it's like this. I think it's a little bit better motivated than that, but not enormously more motivated. Okay, it was truly a strange idea. So one of the things I'll do is a couple of examples to give you a feeling for this. I mean, the bottom line is you can calculate the wavelength of a baseball. And yes, the baseball does have a wavelength.
It's just that wavelength is so tiny that you don't notice it under any circumstances. But if you go to something really tiny, like a subatomic particle, then the wavelength starts to be significant. Okay? So that's sort of where we're going. And now we've got a totally new ballgame. Because now, to understand particle mechanics, especially if you go to things that are very small, which means atoms, for example, or chemistry, turned out to be pretty important things, you can't ignore the wave-like characteristics. So you cannot use sort of a Newtonian mechanics, even combined with relativity, to solve. You have to take into account the fact that you have electrons and particles that have wave-like characteristics. So the equations of motion we solve are not Newtonian-type things, like a ball going around in an orbit.
Paul, and we'll look at that one initially, because that was a very, it can be a successful model at the point. But you now have to actually look at, you have to solve the wave equation for matter. And now that's a different ballgame too, because up until then, people sort of knew how to do wave equations, but you never assigned an inherent mass to the wave. So now it's different from what happens with light, in that you now have mass involved. And so people had to literally invent on the fly in the 1920s and 30s what we now know as quantum mechanics from the ground up. Right? I mean, it's truly what we've learned today. I mean, it's truly a revolution in science. It's almost like a clean slate. You have to sort of figure it out from the get-go. So that's going to be the story now, is how and what were the wave mechanics that they invented, and then what were the implications of it, and how do you know it's right? That's where we're headed. Eric, I will see you in a week and a half, but I'll put lectures on through. I may see you in a week and a half, but I'll board you between now and then very nicely. I hope not more. I actually think this is really cool stuff.
Not sure how to think about the wavelength. Baseball wavelength is baseball.
Tomorrow morning, first thing, so I'll see you.